Hi, everyone, and welcome to People, Nature, Big Ideas. I am your host, Rhonda Lee Chapman, and today is the second of three very special episodes that we're going to be running through April around a very important piece of federal legislation called the Outdoors for All Act. TPL has been leading the effort to pass the Outdoors for All Act for a number of years, and just last year, a lot of TPL supporters and leaders brought their voices directly to DC to raise some attention around it. And since then, the bill's been introduced and it's slowly been making its way through the legislative process. And so we're keeping our hopes high that the act will pass in April, which would bring about $1 trillion to the outdoor recreation economy. And so these three episodes are dedicated to what it means to actually have outdoors for all. And so our first two episodes, we're talking with community partners who share what outdoors means to them, their community, their culture, and we're exploring how investing in the outdoors is ultimately an investment in people and our collective well-being, physically, emotionally, socially, intellectually. And then in April, for our final episode, we're going to follow along with TPL's annual Day on the Hill event here in my hometown in Washington, D.C. And then we're going to talk with lawmakers and advocates. We're going to talk with TPL staff, maybe a couple journalists, and just to discover, like, how do these kinds of legislative bills get created? How do they get passed? What kind of impact they have on communities across the United States? So we're going to go ahead and get started here. And today I'm very happy to welcome three wonderful guests. We have Dr. Darren Ranko, a citizen of the Penobscot Nation, associate professor of anthropology and coordinator of Native American research at the University of Maine. Welcome, Darren.
Good morning. Good to join you.
We also have Chuck Loring. He's also a citizen of Penobscot Nation, and there he is the director of natural resources. So we're going to learn a lot from Chuck as well. So welcome, Chuck.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And then last but not least, we have Dr. Ken Lucero, who is TPL's director of Tribal and Indigenous Lands Program. He's also a member of the Zia Pueblo in New Mexico. Welcome, Ken. We're really glad to have you.
Great. Thank you, Rhonda. I'm glad to be here.
So there is a lot I want to cover today, and I have a list of questions, but just as a friendly reminder, I also want us to be able to keep the conversation a little bit free-flowing. So I do encourage you all to imagine we're sitting by a river, maybe we're basking in the sun, we're drinking something refreshing, our shoulders are down, our feet are warm, and I'm just going to play moderator essentially when I need to. So I'd like to get started and talk a little bit about Penobscot Nation, which is our focus today. And as I often say, a good grounding in true history is really where most stories need to begin. And so we're going to kick off a conversation about the lands and tribal history. And so, Chuck, I'd like to start with you and ask if you can paint a picture of the Penobscot Nation's territory, kind of give us a visual about like how large it is, where it's located in Maine, and then maybe a little bit about your role as the director of the nation's natural resources.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we have 128,000 acres of land scattered out, across the state of Maine, basically. A big focus of that land base is actually, in the Penobscot watershed. No surprise there. We're trying to do what we can to conserve land around that area. We also have a couple of big pieces of land over that's part of the Dead River and the Kennebec watershed over in western Maine and Franklin County. That those few pieces over there equate to 50,000 acres. So we have, 50,000 acres over in that region, 78,000 acres in Penobscot watershed. I think 6,000 acres of those are in Piscataquis County, but they are still within the Penobscot watershed as well. So out of all that land that we have right now, we're at 90,000 roughly acres of trust land, 28,000 acres of land owned in fee simple title. Actually, it's 95,000 acres in trust, I'm sorry. 28,000 in fee simple, and then another 5,000 worth of reservation islands.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Darren, you're a professor and you're partially playing the role of professor, at least to me and definitely to our audience. And so it would be great to get a brief history lesson on, your people. And I feel fairly confident that most schools in the United States did very little, if anything, to educate the majority of us, myself included. And so I know about treaties, I know about lands being seized and a few other things, but it would be really great if you could lay out the conditions that are responsible for the fight for sovereignty and the fight for self-determination for Penobscot Nation.
No, thanks. Thanks, Rhonda and Chuck for the setup. And I just want to say, asking a professor to give a brief history about anything is like, I'll try my best. But I think, one thing to think about is just as a larger context of sort of tribal land holdings in the East. I think it, there are obviously much, much larger reservations out west. But I think in terms of our land holdings, we have some of the we're one of the bigger landholders as tribes, both in fee and in trust lands in the eastern part of the United States, and that includes a bunch of tribes. I don't know, I can't remember the number, but 80 to 100 tribes that are federally recognized, east of the Mississippi. We are one of the larger landholders in that context. I think another piece to really understand in the context of our history is that we are still in our homelands. The residential part of our reservation, Indian Island, which is just a few miles upriver from the town of the city of Bangor, is near the very the location of our traditional large village settlement, which was actually an old town. And then there are these series of islands in the Penobscot River that we have as retained reservation lands from the colonial era. So lands we've never treated away, never been seized from us, and that's a series of islands. I'm sure Chuck has the number. It's like 146 or something like that. That am I close? He's giving me a thumbs up. But that those islands in the middle of the Penobscot River, our watershed, our origin stories put us in this landscape, in this river watershed. And so our caretaking and holy sites and all of our responsibilities are the things that we've maintained for thousands of years in this place. And I think that's it's relatively unusual in the East in particular for this continuity of relation with place, this ongoing responsibility that we have in our original the creator put us in. So I think that's a really important part of this context. The other piece that I would say is, and you mentioned Acadia National Park. So our watershed is the water, the Mount Desert Island where Acadia National Park is primarily located is actually at the mouth of the Penobscot River and the watershed. So in terms of our connection of like where in Maine do we find is our homeland, it is that watershed that empties into the Gulf of Maine and the Atlantic Ocean in and around Mount Desert Island where Acadia is located. So
Okay.
We have many ongoing cultural sites and connections, as do other Wabanaki nations, the Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Passamaquoddy, with places in and around Acadia National Park, again, where we've been, caretakers and stewards for thousands of years. So there is this connection even with Acadia. And I live on the road between Bangor and Acadia, and it's a I love that connection in terms of when my dad was growing up, just that sense of connection to the coast as part of our seasonal round. So summer living, summer cultural connections to coastal resources, and then a seasonal round that put us in the big village sites like where Indian Island slash Old Town are, and then interior for hunting and those sorts of things. So I think obviously the idea of indigenous territory is something that developed over time, often in contact first with other nations. We are part of a confederacy, so we had basically notions of responsibility and caretaking that defined our relationship with place and with the other tribal nations, and that sort of existed for thousands of years before Europeans came and wanted to seize lands in a totally different framework. Around things like property. So I would just say that our claims and sort of our notion of our own territory and basically involves the entire watershed of the Penobscot River. I think when we as Penobscots think about where is our homeland, and so that connects us to the places in and around Acadia, all the way down there, and the coast all the way up through, central and northern Maine, in and around Katahdin and that area as well. So if I were to think of, like, in the mind of most Penobscots, that's our framework of territory. Where that ends, in terms of mapping, this is something. We have a series of clans that have traditional hunting territories in up and down the watershed that defines sort of who we are as a nation. But it's an in constant, both before and since European arrival, in constant relation with our other Confederacy tribes, in the Wabanaki Confederacy. So starting, so we had a series of entanglements, mostly, with the English and French from the starting in the early 17th century. Mostly it was a little bit before, where we basically were trying to preserve our inherent and traditional sovereignty and our stewardship and caretaking roles in our territory. That led to, important diplomacies where we often sided with the French against the English, as the English had much more dubious claims in trying to take our territory. But then, by the 18th century, as Penobscots, we had fought back the English out of our territory pretty significantly, and in a way that sort of defines us as a nation, that we maintained our territory through the middle of the 18th century. So by the time of the American Revolution, we sided against the English with the new Americans, and that led to, again, sort of a respite from incursions from the British and sort of taking of our lands. Early on in the US, as the US came to be a nation state, there were treaties signed, treaties that you could make arguments that they were dubious or not well negotiated, mostly with the state of Massachusetts, which Maine used to be a part of. And that's where we lost significant amounts of our territory. Both us and the Passamaquoddy tribe in the 1790s signed significant treaties where basically we had, almost still the entireties of our homelands as part of our nations. And then these treaties significantly took from those homelands. And it's important, that timeline, because states aren't supposed to sign treaties with tribal nations. And that was actually in violation of federal law starting in 1790, 1791. That actually was the framework of later our land claim settlement in 1980. And I'll just I won't I want to just give you all that structure. There's obviously a
Yeah,
lot
no, it's
between
helpful.
1790s and current day, but
Sure.
that, yeah, in that connection, I think if anyone knows anything about, tribal history, you know that also not only do settlers target lands to take through treaty and these formal agreements, but they also take from the lands that we retain in those agreements, right? So if you people got in a lot of the country, people went through allotment, and so those allotments were supposed to be secure for the tribal citizens of those nations. But often those allotments, if they were on anything good, were targeted and stolen by from settlers and various dubious and fraudulent ways. And we experienced that as well. So even after the 1790s, the state of Maine in particular seized a series of properties for us, Penobscot. There are four townships that we'd retained in and around the Katahdin region because of its importance in for our culture and for our family hunting territories, that they were basically just seized by the state of Maine in the 1830s. So all of that is to say that, again, we retain these islands in the middle of the Penobscot River the whole time. With the settlement in 1980, we're able to, as Chuck pointed out, purchase lands with federal dollars that were given us to be able to the significant acreage of, up to 150,000 acres, as you mentioned, somewhere in the 95,000 and of trust lands, and then 25,000 in fee lands. But just our connection to these places, of course, never wanes, right? I mean, and people are maintaining caretaking and relational responsibility to place, oftentimes in violation of state law. I mean, even my father growing up talks about hunting and fishing, especially fishing at night in a canoe in the river, which was very dangerous. And we have a lot of people who were injured and passed doing this, from the state's perspective, poaching, from our perspective, exercising treaty rights. I think that connection to place is ongoing. Hopefully I haven't gone way over in terms of our history, whatever.
No. I mean, I think it's amazing, and I, I didn't really explicitly say it at the top of this conversation, but we are really going to be talking about self-determination and talking about sovereignty throughout this conversation. And I'm reflecting on a previous episode that we had and speaking with some Black leaders in Chicago who were talking about self-determination in Black neighborhoods and communities and creating self-outdoor spaces that uplift health and connection and, you know, providing resilience for climate change. And what I think is super interesting is when the broad audience, you know, people here in the US and maybe abroad hear Black leaders talk about self-determination, they applaud it as like, oh yes, this is great. This is a powerful thing for you to do, given all of the challenges that you face being, you know, as a result of being marginalized by racist policies over time, redlining, et cetera. But it feels like sometimes when we talk about self-determination or sovereignty for Indigenous people or tribes, people have a very different response. I think sometimes people are reacting in a very negative way where they're not applauding it as something that is great and something to be celebrated. And Ken, I'm wondering if you can speak to us on the nexus of land and Indigenous people and self-determination and what's coming up for you when you think about that comparison or that juxtaposition where it's celebrated for some and not celebrated for all? How are you seeing that intersection?
Well, it's like Darren, I can talk about this probably all day, because there is so much detail and so much nuance that comes to a conversation like this. But I think really what is significantly different when we talk about self-determination among a non-Indigenous or non-tribal population, it's really about where the basis of that self-determination comes from. And for tribes, it's because we are sovereign nations. It is an implicit and agreed upon in a lot of ways by the federal government through the treaties and through the Constitution, Supreme Court decisions, congressional legislation, that tribes are unique and independent sovereign nations, and that we have the authority as independent nations established well before the federal government, well before contact with the Kingdom of Spain and Mexico, that we operated and were established governments of our own people in our own nation. And so, because of that, that self-determination goes back thousands of years. Our ability to self-govern, our ability to manage the lands and manage all the resources that are associated with it comes from that acknowledgement and that recognition that we are independent nations. And so when we talk about the exercise of self-determination as tribal nations, it's often because we're pushing back and upholding treaty responsibilities and the commitments that were made by the federal government and subsequently by the states to uphold our treaty rights, to uphold the Supreme Court decisions, and to uphold executive orders that allow us to hunt, fish, collect plants, herbs, medicines on the lands and have the right to have clean water and clean land that's undisturbed. And so it's a very different conversation, and for a lot of us, very more meaningful, because we know in a lot of ways where we come from. And to take that a little bit deeper, it's really those long-standing thousands of years commitments and connections to the land that are just wholly a part of many tribal nations. You know, the land is our religion. There are sites that we go to pray to. There are, you know, the animals that we pray to, the water, the land, everything that's within that land is a part of our religion, our culture, and our traditional way of life. Now, as a Pueblo person, I am also fortunate, like Darren and Chuck, that I am in the place that my ancestors settled and was not relocated. But there are so many other tribes and so many other tribal people who are not that fortunate. They were relocated and they were taken away from the places that they were meant to be, where their ancestors settled for them. And that's just devastating because of that deep connection to the land, that deep connection to sacred sites in those areas, and because the water and the medicines and again the animals that we're so deeply connected to. So that's particularly devastating for many of our tribes that don't have that ability. But, you know, fortunately, tribes are resilient. The people are resilient. They were relocated and they managed to pick themselves back up and do with what they had, even though knowing in their minds that they had been here for thousands of years and that these are their lands and that they have their own ability to better lives for themselves no matter where they're at, and that they're going to continue to remain true to their traditions as best they can. And so when we talk about that self-determination, it's in a different context and a little bit more deeper in meaning for a lot of us.
I appreciate that. I really do. That was excellent framing, and it's making me think about conservation, right? It's a really complicated, I think, topic, and I don't know if it's something that we want to reimagine, if or do we want to re-reimagine, right? So, in a moment, Darren, I'm going to turn to you because as Ken was just like beautifully laying out, like part of this conservation effort around self-determination and the historic ancestral nation, like nature of that is how the lands are used and how they're managed by the folks who are closest to them, the folks that have relationship, the generational precedent or knowledge and wisdom on how to take care of them. The other day, Darren, I wrote down something that you said. You said that land return is better than a conservation easement. And I didn't want to ask for you to go into it when we were talking because I wanted to save it for this conversation because it felt meaty. And so I'm wondering if you can break that down for me and the audience. And what does that mean? And how might a land return start to, as a regular practice, expand or shift our thinking when it comes to the topic of conservation?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And actually, Ken and I are doing email exchanges where I'm sharing bibliographic sources in this area. And I think my belief as a scholar and as a tribal person, is absolutely in that context. So I come to that both in both from both connections, right? So what has been a really vibrant part of the discussion around conservation since at least 2008 is the notion that where Indigenous people are and where we have some element of control or power over our lands, our retained lands, that's where biodiversity exists, right? So people, since 2008, there's this World Bank report that says we're 4% of the world's population. We have some control over 20 to 22% of the lands around the world, and that's where 80% of the world's biodiversity exists. Now, in 2008, when the World Bank made those assessments, that was simply a correlational thing, right? And you can cut those numbers a bunch of different ways. You can talk about different ways to define biodiversity. You can talk about different ways to even think about where Indigenous people's lands are and how much power and control we actually have over the decision making. And so those numbers can shift and the different ways you define it. But since then, a number of scholars, and I've been sort of indirectly participating in this conversation as a scholar, we're actually understanding that some of the best conservation outcomes around the world are coming when Indigenous people's rights and leadership are endorsed, are sought out by conservation groups. So, I think that is a shifting practice, right, since 2008 in firm forms of recognition. So I think conservationists around the world have taken this up in an uneven way. So there's not a universal kind of a commitment to it. But I think as an emergent set of scholarship and practice, like we are seeing with each passing year, new scientific studies that support Indigenous leadership, Indigenous knowledge systems, Indigenous governance, and I could go through the list of the sources that produce the best conservation outcomes. And so to me, to really endorse Indigenous leadership and trust in Indigenous frameworks for caretaking lands and stewarding lands, which, in its origins come from different places than Western conservation, right? So Western conservation used the use of easements, right? These are deeply embedded in colonial systems around property and how property rights are accrued over time, and how you keep the sort of the idea that in the preservationist conservation debates that humans are supposed to be separate from the things we protect in terms of nature. We really have a different framework as Indigenous people that our caretaking is really a critical part of this framework. And I was involved in a study that came out a couple of years ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that looked at biodiversity and humans' influence on biodiversity over the last 12,000 years. And in that study, which I think is kind of a special and really important study, if I say so myself, that we, you know, we saw that humans, even in with large agricultural systems up until about 400, 500 years ago, humans were really net beneficiaries to biodiversity. And it was only in these last 400 years, which talks about, you know, which is a framework of, you know, the forms of colonialism, capitalism, and extractive frameworks that kind of have come in the last 400 years, that's when humans have really destroyed biodiversity. And the other part of that study is that it wasn't new lands found by humans, that often these systems of colonial extractive frameworks were subsuming previously, you know, places where humans had previously lived and supported biodiversity. So it wasn't that it was just humans destroying as the population grew, but that actually humans had been previously good in a lot of these places. But when we say that, that's mostly indigenous people, right? So these these systems supplanted indigenous frameworks around stewardship and caretaking and the rest. So that's why I say that. I think it's being represented in the literature around indigenous people's leadership and roles in conservation. Well, there's been no sort of systematic study around it, because land returns were relatively new, so we can't do the kinds of like studies of like, oh, this, you know, most of the land returns that we're talking about have happened in this last decade, so we can't really say like long-term conservation goals. But you know, it is because of that, those studies that have measured for these last few 30, 40 years of indigenous leadership and conservation that makes me say that, you know, that we're really, if you really want to support the frameworks that indigenous people bring in terms of protecting place and stewarding to place, land return strikes me as a really critical tool to that. And I think also a game shifter, right? That by shifting somewhat out of the conservation easement property framework and into more indigenous lenses and frames around how to caretake place, I think that's creating, you know, a different set of relations and possibilities that I think, in my opinion, is like really the key piece of how humans are going to continue to exist on this planet beyond the next 100 years. Like if we don't get that piece of that right and have indigenous leadership in those kinds of big decisions around, you know, stewardship and caretaking, then I think, you know, we're relatively doomed, or we're doomed to have a very painful 22nd century, I think.
Sure.
Be what I would say. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. You know, I am many things that are coming up for me, and one of this, and I don't mean to oversimplify it, but you know, years back when I was doing water equity and climate resilience work, and we were really talking about safe and affordable drinking water, and we were working with a couple of indigenous folks, mostly coming out of the Southwest, and one of the things that you were talking about is how humans have that separation, right? That we are separate from biodiversity, we are separate from nature. And, you know, these friends, colleagues, peers, teachers that I was working with really kind of shook me at my soul when they said, you know, water is not a commodity, it is a family member. And I think that our inability to see ourselves in relationship with nature, with biodiversity on a familial level, is why we are where we are. We would never treat our grandmother the way we treat water, right? Where we toxify it, we waste it, we don't build infrastructure to protect it. You know, we would never treat a relative that way. So why on earth are we going to do that with all of these incredible life-sustaining, I don't even know the language, like this is our life. This is where we come from. So I really, and if we could just, if that switch could just go off in somebody's brain, you know, where it's like, oh, wait a minute, let's, you know, talk about this a different way. I think that we wouldn't be, as you're saying, doomed. Which...
So Rhonda, just, I Chuck, you can go too, but let me just share, like you mentioned Acadia National Park, for example. Mm-hmm. My former grad student and now colleague, Suzanne Greenlaw, who's a Maliseet researcher and scholar. She was engaged in creating, the Park Service has this opportunity since 2016, a kind of formal process for allowing for indigenous access for gathering plants and medicine. There's these cooperative agreements that can happen with parks. And so she was involved in research, which was basically proving, of course, in order to get this access agreement, we have to prove that us as indigenous people will not harm that resource. Which is crazy. Okay, it's crazy making in my whole brain for that. But, the teaching around sweetgrass for us as Wabanaki people is that if we take care of it, it will take care of us. And caretaking is an active thing, right? So, our languages are verb oriented. We have to, we have to pick it to take care of it, but pick it in the means and ways that we pick it. In terms of the study that she established in the context of Acadia National Park, and this has been highlighted, and the Park Service has highlighted the results of this study, is simply because by using also indigenous research methods, which employs sort of how we would pick the grass, not sort of how a botanist would determine we pick the grass around plots, but actually how do we pick it? Her study reveals the thing that we knew already as indigenous people was if we pick it the way we want to pick it, it's not, we don't destroy it. In fact, the next year and 2 years out, there's more of that, right? So we pick it in a way that nurtures its foundation in the world as a key spiritual, economic, and cultural resource for us. So that idea of keeping it separate from humans and not actively caretaking it is the violation, and actually produces the dissolution of this important resource. And so I just that is a foundational difference in the way we understand problems as Indigenous people, is an active role of caretaking and engagement. And that's our responsibility. Sorry.
I love it. No, Chuck, and I see you coming to life as we're talking about this. And given that you are Director of Natural Resources, I can understand why this is super important. So I'd love to hear some of your reflections.
Yeah, I mean, like Darren was saying, we look at, and you were saying too, we look at these resources as a relative, which includes the moose and the deer that we harvest for our families, that they give their life to sustain ours. The idea of conservation amongst Native people is really interesting when you think about there's 2,400, 2,500 of us that are still in existence today. Those of us that are of hunting age and able to hunt, we're able to take one moose per household, right? If you break that down, I mean, there's probably, that could be up to, 800,000 moose, I'm guessing. I mean, I don't know. I don't really have any good data on households, but I think that's a fair enough. And the fact that, we might harvest, 60 moose in a given year is I think that kind of says, something about our people and how responsible we are with that resource.
I love hearing that. And since your mic is on, I want to ask you to build on that a little bit. And you talked about this a little bit at the top of the conversation around people who are opponents to land back. Have this, I will call it a false narrative, that tribal nations and indigenous people don't have the proper capacity or the competence to manage their own lands, and they're going to create overregulation, which is going to limit the access for non-native peoples, and they're going to overdevelop it and put a bunch of casinos everywhere. And I'm just curious if you can talk about some of what you've heard when people are pushing back against land back.
Yeah, I think pushing it up back against land back, which is also where we have sovereignty legislation going through in the state legislature right now, that's where a lot of that stuff is coming up, and it's coming up around that, land back. And so I think it's basically meant to instill fear. It's a narrative that they come up with that supports their opposition to our progress, basically, which is one vote, one person. It was that we're not going to be protective enough of the land around the town that he represents. And then, you got the next person saying from the Maine Forest Products Council that we're going to overregulate, and they're worried about, discharging into the river, and, kind of combat against that and follow up with, Clean Water Act Section 401 consultation and comments. So, just like everything, right? The truth lies somewhere in the middle. And I think that's a perfect example of it, is that, we're still going to utilize the land and utilize the forest resources, just in a responsible manner that our tribe and council and chief have deemed appropriate for for our resources there. But when that testimony came out and I was listening to it, it was kind of frustrating because it's like, it's one of those things, we have this data sovereignty too, where we don't, this stuff's all tribal business, right? It's not really something that, you know, that we feel should be shared throughout the whole world. But at the same time, it's like, if we, you know, were to share a forest management plan, I guess people would probably see like where we're coming from and, you know, our riparian areas, you know, we quote unquote zone, you know, I was educated in Western science, you know, at the University of Maine. So I have to use some of those terms once in a while, but, you know, our stream buffers, et cetera, are, you know, 1.5 to 2 times as strict as some of the state standards are. I think it's better management. It's going to give you more, it's going to allow trees in those stream buffers and lake buffers and river buffers to actually fall in and create habitat. Whereas now, kind of one of the big catch terms for conservation and streams is adding, you know, wood to the streams. And we worked with some partners that wanted to come out on our lands and help, you know, kind of come up with some plans to for a regional conservation partnership. And when they came out there and they looked at the stream, they're like, oh, we're going to add, you know, wood to the Kennebago watershed, but we don't have to do that over here. Like, you guys already have the wood, like, you know, and what do we need is just better fish passage. So we need to put, you know, a bridge in place of an old culvert that was put in, you know. That's where we're going with that. But we also have, you know, mountainous areas where we stay out of, I believe it's 2,700 feet in Western Maine, which the mountains over there are like 3,300 or 4,000 feet. We harvest, we don't allow harvest up above that. But well, anyway,
I want to go back just a couple of seconds, because you were talking about how your standards are twice as stringent as state standards. And I just want to highlight that. Can you talk a little bit about that? And by that, I mean, you know, kind of process that you all undertake to make those decisions.
It's, you know, everything is decided through general meeting, chief and council for any rule changes, law changes. We have a general meeting once a year, and that's where the law change proposals come in. But as far as chief of council, obviously approves the forest management plan, you know, it had a series of surveys, I guess, that went out to the community to various, like, you know, how do they use the land, you know, et cetera, just to get kind of a feedback on like hunting versus, you know, just straight recreation, fishing, et cetera. You know, obviously we try to tailor that plan to encompass all that. Water quality is one of the first and foremost, well, it is the first and foremost goal, but then we also have, you know, hunting, fishing, recreation. It is a consistent income that we've relied upon since we started the forestry program. And that helps fund, you know, some positions that like wouldn't, you know, be funded through federal grants, and keeps things going in that sense.
I appreciate the level of, not only the practice of this deep community engagement, where it's not just outreach, where you're just posting signs about what's coming, but you're actually getting their input. And then you're recognizing where some of the holes are and filling the gaps and being able to create workforce for the younger folks that are living in the nation. And I think that's fantastic. I mean, it's the model that we try to employ in a lot of our community-based organizations. And I see that it's not different for you all at all. I'm going to transition us over just a moment to Ken. We were talking, and let me know if I got this right. I think you had mentioned that tribally controlled lands are not considered conservation. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, how might we think about a better way to frame this idea around conservation and tribally controlled lands?
Sure. Well, thank you, Rhonda. I guess what I meant by that is really that non-tribal conservation entities, folks that maybe aren't intimately aware about Indigenous-led conservation efforts, don't consider the efforts that tribes make to be quote unquote traditional conservation.
Okay.
Because it is different. And even like TPL is different in conservation world because we support people's access to lands. And that's, I think, what Darren talked about and Chuck talked about, is that, you know, in order to really care for the land, you have to be on the land. You have to be with the land. You have to be doing the things that we've learned over centuries of how to properly care for that land and for those animals and for those plants and for that water. And so I think what needs to happen is that traditional conservation, maybe the larger picture, needs to expand its understanding and its definition of what conservation can be. You know, Darren had talked about that earlier as well, is that, you know, you can slice and dice biodiversity by what it means and how you define it in many, many different ways. And so that's what we need to begin to do, is really be inclusive of all types of ecological caretaking for the land and the water, and ensure that we are part of the conversation, that you recognize that the traditional ecological knowledge is valid, and that it goes back, you know, thousands, like I said, of years of caretaking and experience of being on the land and being a part of that land. And, you know, yes, sometimes the rules and regulations that we put in place within the community are more stringent than external to the reservation, but there's a reason to that, because they understand what's happening to the land, what's happening to the water. You know, and a perfect example, in the early 90s, the Pueblo of Isleta in New Mexico implemented its own water standards, had a huge impact on the city of Albuquerque, from which it's downstream from, and they didn't like it, but it was for the ability for tribal members to be able to go to that river, to be able to even set foot in that river and be able to use it for its traditional and cultural customs. And so, you know, they had to do a lot of things to make sure that the water was clean, where before it was not clean. But those are necessary and important steps for us, and it's our right as tribal nations to incorporate that on our tribes and for our waters and for our people. And ultimately, it's what's right for Mother Nature and for the climate and for
That's
the earth
right.
going forward and for future generations.
That's right.
So,
That's
you
right.
know, I think people that are now in traditional conservation organizations, you know, even philanthropical organizations, just need to expand their thoughts and be inclusive of, you know, what really is going to help us to have a better world, for future generations that we're going to leave to our children. You know, a lot of
Absolutely.
tribal leaders always talk about, you know, this isn't for us. This is for the future generations. And we're only here, we're only borrowing the land from our children and from their children.
That's right.
And
That's
so, you know,
right.
what can we do in our time here on this earth to make that better? And when they look back 100 years from now and they say, you know, what did my grandfather do to help make this place a better world? Did they leave it in a better place for me, or did they make it worse? And so that's the responsibility that we carry as tribal people, and that we tell each other that that's our responsibility.
Man, I am. You just, I had this little synapse misfire in my brain because you just opened up a new way of thinking. At the start of the call, I set us up to talk about the Outdoors for All Act, and what just happened for me in my brain is the definition of all. I think that oftentimes, at least in the context, the way I have been thinking about it, and we've been thinking about it, maybe with the legislation or even in at TPL, and we talk about, everybody having a right to the outdoors. I don't know that we're thinking about it in terms of future generations. So, and reflecting and honoring past generations. So now all for me, just the definition of all just changed. So thank you for that. It's much broader. It's
Rhonda,
much, much broader.
I also want to just, if you could also shift for all, for us, it also means non-humans. So, we, along with other indigenous people around the world, we, you know, the river itself is one of, as a citizen of our nation, and it has rights like others, and I think, you know, there have been a lot of indigenous peoples, as well as even in countries like Bolivia and elsewhere, where, you know, the rights of nature, you know, have been an active discussion. But I mean, I think in terms of our ongoing sovereignty and caretaking responsibilities, that's the shift, right? I mean, it's, as you mentioned, the all includes future generations, but also with our non-human relations, because, you know, as many indigenous people, our clan systems are based around our relations, kin relations with animals and insects and all sorts of other things. So I think it's a really important understanding. Again, this is why is indigenous caretaking stewardship different, is because those are the original instructions that we're acting out. I think that becomes a really important part of why is it, not just conservation, but conservation with indigenous leadership? Though that's the difference making, is that our relational responsibility is so critical to it and involves non-humans as well as humans.
I also wonder too, the origin stories. There are many, many origin stories from various indigenous peoples here and around the world. And the origin stories that I've heard about creation are actually, many of them are birthed through our animal kingdom, right? And so I think that the non-native folks who have a very different origin story, I think therein lies maybe a little bit of the difference in the philosophies that we're bringing into these relationships and how we kind of live on this earth, because we don't have that same connection to how we came to be. So I just, you're, a lot of things are happening for me in my brain, but I don't want to make this about me, but I'm so grateful.
So Rhonda, just for one of our key origins is our trickster hero, Gluskabe, shooting an arrow into the ash tree, and then the river and the people and the animals and the plants all coming bursting out of the ash tree. So when we think about the critical cultural importance of us, caretaking ash, and but also our origins being in a particular r watershed, having that as a foundational kind of narrative. And then we have all sorts of other stories that us fighting against a frog, that swallows up all the resources in the and all the water in the river, and us solving that and making sure that there's a balance for all the creatures, as Gluskabe is our teacher. I think these are all, these are just, that's like the shortest hand possible of telling these really in-depth stories. But just to give you a sense of like, where is our placemaking and how does that connect to our caretaking roles is just so critical.
I'm going to turn it back to you, Ken, in just a second. But again, this is the second in our three-part series leading up to Day on the Hill. We were talking about the Outdoors for All Act. And so, Ken, I've got kind of a two-part question for you, one of which is helping us understand how this type of legislation can help Native and Indigenous communities. And then the second part of that question is your point of view on where some of this legislation or programming might fall short, or maybe don't really align with many Indigenous and tribal community needs.
Okay, sure. So the Outdoors for All Act is pretty comprehensive, and so like when we talk about specific benefits for tribes, it's really focused on the Outdoor Recreation Legacy Partnership, ORLP, a component of the Outdoors for All Act. And so there are very specific amendments to that program that would allow tribes better access to the funds. So as we know, the program, ORLP is funded from the LWCF, Land and Water Conservation Fund. That funding is recurring. It's always available. And so it's a really good source of conservation funding specifically for outdoor recreation, in talking about the ORLP. But what the specific provisions that have been included are added now is that Native American event sites and cultural gathering spaces are eligible activities under the program. In addition to that, states would no longer administer this program, and tribes could apply directly to ORLP, which is managed by the National Park Service. And so instead of having to work through your state, which oftentimes states don't have good relationships with tribes, or tribes don't have good relationships with the states, tribes would then be able to go directly to the Park Service and apply for these different types of funding. And of course, an oversight that should never have happened is it allows tribal organizations, Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians to be eligible applicants for the program. Yeah, and I think the other piece of that is that there's not a population requirement. Traditionally, under the program, there was a minimum population that it needed to serve in order to be eligible for the grants. But now that there's not a population requirement for the tribes, for the tribal organizations to apply for these funds. So that is all great in terms of getting easier, more direct access to these funds. But I think what is problematic for a lot of tribes is the this and it's true with not only this but other public funds is the requirement for public access. The idea that if you were going to acquire a certain amount of land and that when you utilize these funds to do that, that everybody has access to that land any time and every time. And a lot of times that is kind of at odds with tribes and them being their own sovereign entity and having the ability to regulate what happens on lands that they own or that are part of the reservation system. And so that oftentimes is something that prohibits a tribe from wanting to access these funds because they don't want to provide that access. So I think for me, that's something that still needs to be worked out and you know, possibly could be done through the agreements that happen with the National Park Service. As you and all of us know, you know, when we talk about the national parks and we talk about other federally managed lands, they are not open to the public 24/7. They have times that they are closed, they have times that they're open, and there's not 24/7 public access. So I think there's a way that we can find to, I guess, not necessarily limit or prohibit public access, but there's a better way that we can control it. And it's all not only just for the safety of tribal members, but it's also for the safety of the land and the water and the animals.
I'm curious to hear from Chuck and Darren. Darren, you want to go ahead?
There's so many important elements to this, and I think this represents, we now have Indigenous people leading Interior and the National Park Service. So that I think that rec that's a key part of this work is that it's Indigenous leadership to finally include us in this particular set of programs. Obviously, is critical, but this is one of many that again, also in the context of the federal government. The requirement to, for each agency to have a framework to include Indigenous knowledge, right, and traditional environmental knowledge from the tribes, into their frameworks. Like this is a shift. It's a significant shift. I mean, I'm both optimistic about what that recognition of our knowledge systems is, and then realize like. Because I train students to try to do this work, it's exceedingly difficult work to bring different knowledge systems together, especially when it's been bureaucratized for generations in a really specific set of paradigms, right? So this is challenging work, but we're aiming to do that together. So I would just, in terms of that, I think it's this is representing so much of the possibilities around. Recognizing Indigenous leadership. So I think, that's what I'm thinking. And I think, we've seen this shift in the land trusts and conservation community, and TPL is, in my opinion, now at the forefront of these discussions, shifting the understanding and role that Indigenous people can have, as leaders. And it makes sense that TPL is has always been a little bit of like thinking outside the box around some of these issues and being really serving the kinds of interests that are not often represented in the conservation movement. So I think to me that makes a lot of sense, and they're doing it diligently. And just I'll open up for Chuck to talk about the project that TPL is supporting in the with our nation. But yeah, I think there's a lot of really important moving parts. It's a lot of really important work that represents to me a paradigm shift, but a paradigm shift that is a response to the kinds of crises that we face, both with climate, environment, and otherwise. And I just, having that possibility of a shift is something I don't even think, 5 or 6 years ago, I would have been like, oh yeah, we're gonna work with land trusts and conservation groups, and they're gonna help return land to us because they are now aligned with our goals and responsibilities to these future generations and these non-humans. I mean, that's just it's a reverse of a trend for hundreds
Yeah,
of
you
years,
never
right?
saw it coming. Never saw it coming.
Taking
I
the
love
lead
it.
from us, right? So I think it's a really significant time to engage in this work.
That's great. Chuck, what are your thoughts?
I just remember when there's a colleague of mine that used to work here as a wildlife biologist, and then she works in the conservation easement realm through the Forest Society of Maine now. But she actually brought Betsy to the office one day, Betsy Cook, the Maine State Director from TPL, just kind of do an introduction. And then they're like, "Oh, we have this, this thing we want to talk to you about." It's like, all right, they want a chief there. And so we had Chief and Mark Chevry, the tribe's legal representation, for that. They walked in and kind of laid this plan out for 30,000 acres in the Katahdin region, and we all kind of just sat there and we're like, "Wow, is this for real? What's the catch here?" You know what I mean? And I remember when we left that meeting, Chief just kind of looked at me like he does with many of these things, and he's like, "Make it happen." Then heads out. So yeah, that's what we've been doing now. So
Well, I want to ask you to dig in a little bit deeper because I don't know how many people in our listening audience are familiar with the Katahdin Project. And I think that, it is something that, TPL is very honored to be a part of. And I do want to shout out Betsy Cook. She's a fantastic leader and relationship builder, and she's really dedicated to doing the right thing. So thank you for naming her. But it's a landmark land return project between the Penobscot Nation and TPL. You already mentioned it's 30,000 acres, but can you share a little bit more about it? Like you just very briefly touched on the process. Like we had this meeting and then this thing happened and here we are, which is awesome. But
that's my
I think there are
summary.
probably some folks that would love to have the blanks filled in just a little bit, if you don't mind. That would be
Absolutely.
great.
I think, well, I spoke with the cultural director too, and right after Betsy came and spoke about this with us. And we were talking about the proximity to the Katahdin Woods and Waters Monument, as well as proximity to existing trust land that we have in Grindstone. That proximity, the connection to some of the tributaries in the East Branch, being close to the Millinocket areas was very attractive to us as well. It was, sustainably managed forest land for that. Looking at the land and seeing there's so many water features in there. There's Soldier Brook, Gude Stream, Trout Brook, Trout Pond, Soldier Pond. The East Branch runs through kind of in between a couple of the parcels there, East Branch of the Penobscot. And, and the wetland features in there, there's just so much different habitat in there. And it's just a really interesting piece of land to look at. And then, you got a lot of pine forest in there, a lot of spruce fir. It's just a nice mix of forest products as well. It's kind of daunting, you got 30,000 acres, and you go up there and ride around, and it takes an hour and a half to get up there from my house in the morning. It takes an hour and a half to get back. So then, if you're doing a 10-hour day, you got 7 hours up there, and it's still hard to, hit it all just because you got to stop and take it all in. But.
That's wonderful. I mean, for folks who, I for many of us who myself are visual learners, so like 30,000 acres is about, which is almost the size of San Francisco, almost exactly the size of San Francisco. So that's a good kind of reference for us who try to see like what could this really look like? I'd love to hear. I have a concluding question that I want to ask, but as we're talking about this particular Katahdin exchange, I didn't know if Ken or Darren wanted to share anything in addition to what Chuck had to say about its significance.
Rhonda, I just want to say, I think of it because the name for the project is, Wahsatch, and it's our word for the East Branch of the Penobscot River, actually. So I kind of refer to it in my mind in the English as the East Branch Project, not the Katahdin Project. Although I would love to get back Katahdin into our land holding, so if TPL can help us do that, that would be great. Sorry, that's been this whole.
That's for
That's
you, Ken.
a state park that I don't see the state of Maine letting go of anytime soon. Yeah, no, I think it's so significant. It does connect our lands to the National Monument area, which I think is really important because there's a lot of cultural history in the East Branch. I mentioned these family hunting territories and connection to some of our clans. Like that's the location of some really key ones in terms of our cultural history. So the return and just the overall beauty of that piece of land and its importance to us culturally is just it's just so significant, and it allows us to have those roles. Those are roles of caretaking that place.
Yeah. Thank you. I love it. I'm glad, so happy that it's happening. Ken, you just got probably the biggest charge to your role. Katahdin, get to it. No, seriously. And with Wasatic, is there anything that you wanted to share? Any closing thoughts on Wasatic? And then we'll close out.
Yeah, so just to give the audience a little bit more context about the project, I'm going to pull up some notes so I don't get the facts wrong. But really, this is an important project between the Trust for Public Lands and the Penobscot Nation. Members of the Wabanaki Nations, which include the Penobscot Nation, legally steward only about 1% of their ancestral lands in present-day Maine. So this effort that we're undertaking with the nation will return 30,000 acres to the Penobscot Nation, which will add to the already existing 120,000 acres that they currently manage for the benefit of their people and the land. At the same time, this project's going to create vitally needed southern access to the Gadatin Woods and Waters National Monument, which really enhance the public's experience of this cherished national site, and it's going to bolster economic benefits to the surrounding town. So this access is really going to be important in the long-term vision for the monument. So just again, for context, how important this is for our organization, but most importantly for the Penobscot Nation.
Well, folks, we have talked a lot today about self-determination. We've talked around issues around sovereignty and colonialism. We've talked about the legacy of land loss, and we've talked about traditional ways and native life ways when it comes to land use and stewardship. And I think that by and large, folks in the US need to engage in dialogue that can dispel a lot of the false narratives and myths that lead to significant gaps in understanding about history and culture and even power. I'm really grateful for the education that I receive, but I get frustrated when I think about all of the parts of history, my own history, your history, that just got selectively omitted. So even as we're talking about these land return opportunities, we're talking about conservation and the various forms or shapes that conservation can have, we're creating an opportunity for all of us to kind of relearn and decondition some of the conditioning that we've had, which I'm grateful for. So I know that we're at time. I know Darren's probably messaging people. I'm going to be there in 5 minutes. Is there anything else, one final thought that you want to either promote to folks to take action on, or one key takeaway that you want the audience to have from this conversation?
Obviously, I'm in meetings a lot around land return, in a general way. And one thing that captures the imagination for both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people is, we mentioned one of them, which is, that this is a hopeful shift around the future of humanity on our planet. But also for us as Indigenous people, the notion of healing relations to our places is so significant and is so motivating and hopeful as well. Those are sort of the parts of the historic and cultural traumas that we as Indigenous people have suffered is this disconnect from our places, and the reconnect possibilities as frameworks for healing are so vital and so important. And I just wanted to mention that because we hadn't mentioned that piece of it. We mentioned it more in the justice kind of framework, but I think for us, it's so much more than that too, So I think that has to be mentioned.
Thank you for that. Chuck, what about you?
I think it's really important to remember, I talked about the East Branch. Darren talked about the significance of the East Branch as well. But, the groundwater coming in from the Katahdin region is what really charges that cold water system. That's a really important piece of salmon habitat right now for Atlantic salmon. And we're the kind of the last stronghold in the state of Maine in the Penobscot watershed for the continental United States for Atlantic salmon. So, and we do a lot of work with that. That makes this project that much more, special to us. And, and also like looking at it, I kind of forgot to say this when we were talking earlier, but when I looked at this piece of land, the first time I went up and looked at it, I took our water resource manager, Dan Kuzniers, with me. We get up there and that's like, all right, and we both instantly were like, oh, I wonder where the first bridge we're going to come to is and what kind of condition that is. And, it's kind of like almost like a project in itself. Like we look at some of our other lands as projects, and we just completed a big area in Matanuskas. So now we're going to be, hopefully working on this in the future. So
Awesome.
really excited about that.
Thank you, Chuck. Ken, what are your closing thoughts for this conversation?
I guess the only thing that comes to mind for me is that, you know, we have come such a long way as tribal communities and as folks that live on this land, are responsible for the land. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, we didn't think we would be in this place that we are today. But yet here we are. And so I think what always comes to mind is just something that my grandfather always used to tell us about all the things that we believe in and the things that we do. And then it's just to believe that things are possible, believe that there is a higher power, however you want to contextualize that you have to believe that these things are possible and that you have to put your effort in and do it, even if it seems impossible. But you always got to always cling on to that belief that things are possible.
Love it. Thank you. Thank you. Well, this was a really informative, educational conversation for me, and it also touched me in my heart, which is usually how I measure success when things give me feelings. And so, listening audience, we were talking with Dr. Darren Ranko, we were talking with Chuck Loring Jr., and we were talking with Dr. Ken Lucero, all of whom are just wonderful human beings. And I'm so grateful that they gave me some of their time and gave you some of the time. People Nature Big Ideas is produced by the Trust for Public Land in partnership with Pretty Good Productions. Our executive producer is Thomas Clayton Miller. Our producer is Vanessa Martin, and our associate producer is Alyssa Morley. Our theme song was produced by Tall Black Guy Productions. And if you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes and maybe mention us to one or two of your friends. And certainly reach out to these wonderful guests and leaders that we just had a conversation with if you're interested in supporting their work or even learning a little bit more. I thank you for listening, and we will see you all next time.